This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. USC is number one, or so the experts say, and Tennessee and Texas are expected both to play with quite enough success to stay among the very best. Much lower on the list are Fresno State and all the rest. We'll find out now which teams that I have failed to mention might file suits against me soon for that quite unintended slight. Joining me now on the line to preview the 2005 college football season and perhaps keep me out of legal trouble is Yahoo Sports national columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Another season.
There we go. And as I did last year, I'd like to recommend that the term BCS not be used in our conversation, or we'll be forced to hear the following sound. So, all right, is that a deal?
It's a three-letter word that gives four-letter words a bad name.
That's exactly how we should regard it. There's been a lot of hype surrounding the upcoming Monday night game between Miami and Florida State. Is this because it's a legitimately intriguing matchup, or because college football fans are used to week one matchups like Old Fred's University and Storm Door Company against Truth or Consequences Polytech?
It is a legitimate game because annually Florida and Florida State have two of the top five or ten teams in the country. So there's actual, I'll say, national championship implications. So I don't want the buzzer.
Be very careful.
I'm very careful. It's also always usually an exciting game because most of these kids grew up playing high school football against each other. So there's a lot of rivalries and pounding. And unfortunately, it is an increasingly rare early season game that actually matters because the profiteers that run college football have given us an increased slate of Sisters of the Poor versus Big State U and a lot less of the two very good teams playing each other that used to be the staple of September. And unfortunately, we're not getting that.
The consensus seems to be that two-time national champion USC is the team to beat once again this year. What do you think? Do the Trojans three-peat, to borrow a basketball term?
Well, they return about 17 starters from last year's BCS champion.
Oh, my gosh, he said it. Uh-oh. Well, okay. The time is short, so I'll move right along.
Fun to go with. They return a bunch of players. They also return the Heisman Trophy winning quarterback in Matt Leinart, a talented running back in Reggie Bush. Pete Carroll, the coach, is back for his fifth season. So they certainly have the players and the ability to go and win a third straight title. They did lose most of their assistant coaches. A lot of them were considered kind of cutting-edge geniuses in college football schemes. So whether that plays a role or not, we'll see. But SC is consensus number one for a good reason. They, on paper, they look like the best team.
So if they really fall on their faces, assistant coaches all over the country will be thanking their lucky stars and
demanding
pay
raises. Yes. It'll be a good year to be an agent for an assistant coach.
The Rose Bowl is this season's national championship game, though most prognosticators agree that USC will be there on January 4th. Nobody seems to agree on who USC's opponent might be. What do you think?
There's two teams I like. One is the University of Florida, which has a new coach, Urban Meyer, that took the University of Utah to an undefeated season last year. He's a great young coach. He takes over at Florida, where there is a ton of talent waiting for him. I could see Florida coming a little out of the woodwork and running the table and getting into the championship game. The other team I really think's got a chance is University of Louisville, not because I think they're the second-best team in the country, but they play an extremely weak schedule, which would allow them to go undefeated during the season and have the easiest road to make the Rose Bowl. And then there's the sentimental favorite. I'll give you one more, is LSU, which has good enough to make a run to the Rose Bowl, and I think we'll have most of America rooting for them after the hurricane.
The Atlantic Coast Conference realignment began in 2004 with the addition of Miami and Virginia Tech, and conference officials swear that the inclusion of Boston College this year completes the makeover of the conference. So who joins the ACC in 2006?
Well, anytime a college football executive or administrator is talking, you're pretty sure that he's lying.
His lips are moving. That's
how
you know.
Yeah, if they took a polygraph, they'd be electrocuted. Right now, I think the ACC is set for the time being, but they have 13 teams, which isn't a great number. The real next domino to fall is what the Big Ten does, because they have 11 teams and would like to go to 12. Now, do they poach someone from someone else? once that happens, it's a house of cards and everything gets washed anew.
8 conferences will use instant replay this year. What, if any, effect will that have on college football?
Well, to make it longer.
Great.
More sunburns in the stands and dehydration after the tailgating party. I think it's just another step in what is really, at some point they have to admit, is just a straight professional league. I think it's a good thing because, you know, people care, and if you can correct a mistake or two, I think that's fine. It's fair for everybody involved. However, it just makes it more like the NFL.
USC quarterback Matt Leinart will earn his degree after he completes a course in ballroom dancing, the extent of his curriculum this fall. Will a Rose Bowl serve as a sort of practicum for him to reveal his newly learned rumba, salsa, and merengue steps?
The real scandal here is Matt Leinart's looking at the schedules of the other All-American players around the country and saying, how come I have such a hard schedule compared to some of these guys? Underwater basket weaving is a very difficult major, Bill. And so this guy's got to go and dance.
Yeah, it's hard
work. Once a week with his girlfriend, who's a basketball player, and that's tough. You can't fix that final exam. You can either rumba or you can't. There's no cheat sheet. So you got to look at the reality of college football. We don't have a lot of pre-meds out there.
Yahoo Sports national columnist Dan Wetzel covers all manner of sport and joins me from time to time to discuss the undergrads and postgrads on the gridiron. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Bill.
Decades of savvy marketing and the establishment of the Sunday television ritual have made the NFL the most popular and most lucrative sports league in the country. And now, as if the league needed help, a cyber hobby once ostensibly frowned upon by the NFL is bringing more fans to pro football. Ben Philpott of member station KUT in Austin, Texas, reports.
Ross and Boyga. Nice pick, Cowan.
It's 1:30 on a Saturday afternoon in Birmingham, Alabama. A group of 30-somethings have gathered for one of the most anticipated sporting events of the year, an event that brought college buddies from 4 other states, including as far away as Texas.
With the first pick in the 2005 Southeast Fantasy Football League draft, the Hoover Reapers take Deuce McAllister.
The men of the Southeastern Fantasy Football League spread out around the room, huddled over laptops, scouring over stats and player projections. A giant draft board sits in the middle of the room, keeping track of every player picked.
Who's on the clock?
Let's see, we got Rebel up.
Does he know that he's up?
I don't know. Is he online?
To an outsider, the event may look, well, geeky, and even somewhat covert. But as far as the NFL and its players' union are concerned, events like these are encouraged. That's because fantasy football has become a cash cow for the NFL and its players. Mark St. Amant wrote the book Committed, Confessions of a Fantasy Football Junkie. He says there was a time when the league was less than thrilled about the phenomenon.
They basically clamped their hands over their ears and you know, started humming very loudly. But then once they started to sniff the money that could be made, they jumped all over it. The NFL would not have exploded as quickly as it has without the obsessive nature of the fantasy players wanting to know about the stats and the players and et cetera. So it's really, really helped the NFL explode.
About 15 million people play fantasy football annually, and just about everyone spends much more than the $100 to $120 average league fee to feed the hobby. There are also subscriptions to fantasy publications and online player rankings. Since fantasy football is about feeling like you own an NFL team, there's the desire to own a piece of your team's players. Again, Mark St. Amant.
Fantasy players will buy the jerseys. So in other words, before someone living in Maine wouldn't necessarily buy a LaDainian Tomlinson San Diego Chargers jersey. But now, hey, if they got LaDainian on their fantasy team, they're going to run out to Athlete's Foot and buy the LT jersey.
Tomlinson only had the 7th best rushing stats in the NFL last year, but he's the creme de la creme of fantasy football. Until last year, he'd never played for a winning team, and San Diego isn't exactly one of the more popular teams in the NFL. Normally, that would place Tomlinson in a marketing black hole. Great player, bad team, little notoriety. But even when the Chargers went 4-12 2 years ago, fantasy football helped make Tomlinson one of the most popular players in the league. Clay Walker is senior vice president with Players Inc., the NFL Players Union.
He's someone that has benefited from that, and there are dozens of other players around the league just like him that are super talented that would otherwise go unnoticed because they're in San Diego or Cincinnati or Kansas City, but because they're terrific players, they're now getting greater recognition.
And with that recognition comes endorsements and TV talk shows and more money for players. That's why Players Inc. has fully embraced fantasy football.
We were the first organization to really take a look at this and say, there's some economic growth here. This is positive. This is player-centric. And we really took it out of the black market and made it a legitimate product.
For Players Inc., legitimizing means making sure the union was ready to capitalize on the explosion of internet leagues in the 1990s and send some money back to the players. In 1989, Players Inc. began charging leagues a fee to use players' names and information. No license, no league. And in 1994, the league began offering the subscription service NFL Sunday Ticket, a service that lets fans watch all 16 NFL games each week. Dan Masonson is a corporate communications manager with the NFL. He says the vast majority of people who buy the $239 package also play fantasy football.
You may have Steelers fans in Pittsburgh who watch every Steelers game religiously, but in addition are watching another game and a half or two games following other players who are on their fantasy teams.
Clay Walker of Players Inc. says those unfamiliar with fantasy football might be amazed at the revenue it generates.
The economic impact's probably somewhere, it's certainly north of $1.5 billion, probably closer to $2.5
billion. That's billion with a B, and that total is only expected to go up in coming years. Both Players Inc. and the NFL are launching new fantasy football programs this season. Back in Birmingham, SEFFL Commissioner Hal Stafford is still poring over player stats for his picks. He's a six-year fantasy football veteran, and he's a prime example of how fantasy football increases fan interest in the NFL, even if the hobby hasn't been kind to him.
No, I have not gotten squat. I continue to put money in and never get anything out, but I do it for the love of fantasy football.
For Only a Game, I'm Ben Philpott in Birmingham, Alabama.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a story that may ease your mind if you've always felt race car drivers need divine intervention more than most other athletes. But first, on Tuesday, at the U.S. Open Tennis Championships in New York, Gilles Muller gave fans of the underdog reason to cheer. He beat Andy Roddick in the first round. Much of the rest of the tournament has gone according to form so far. Among those through to round three is James Blake, winner of the Pilot Pen Tournament in New Haven last week, and a serious candidate for Comeback Player of the Year. Howard Axelrod recently wrote about James Blake for the New York Times Sunday magazine, and he joins me now from Arizona. Howard, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
I don't want to use up all our time on the answer to the first question, so please give us the abbreviated version of the trials of James Blake.
It's hard to give an abbreviated version to something that is itself so lengthy. But last year in May, during a practice session after the Italian Open, Blake broke his neck. He crashed into the net post at full speed, broke his neck. He wasn't paralyzed. He went home to Connecticut. 8 weeks later, his father died of stomach cancer. A week after that, Blake came down with zoster, a virus which is triggered by stress. That virus paralyzed half of his face, leaving him unable to blink, unable to smile, impeding his vision, his balance, his taste, his hearing. And that did not clear up for 6 months.
Oof. So the virus actually ended up being worse for him to endure than breaking his neck did.
That's right. It took far longer for him to recover from the virus, and he also told me that the virus was far more painful than the broken neck.
I think one of the more remarkable things James Blake said to you as you prepared your story was, quote, "The luckiest thing that happened to me was breaking my neck." How was it that he felt that way?
It is a remarkable thing. During the time his father had stomach cancer, his father had been diagnosed in July of the year before, actually when Blake was at Wimbledon. During that time, Blake's father did not want him to come off tour, did not want him to change his schedule to come home and visit. Blake would call him from the road. His father would give him good reports always, no matter what was happening. Mm. And then a week or two later, Blake would be talking to his mother while his father was out of the house, and he would learn that, in fact, the treatment wasn't working, or that his father had had to go back into the hospital for a couple days. And so it was extremely difficult for Blake on tour to play his matches, to concentrate on the task at hand, while knowing his father was at home dying, and while also knowing that his father would not allow him to come home to visit.
But once he had broken his neck and obviously couldn't play tennis for some period of time, his father couldn't say, hey, get back out there on the tour, so they had some time together.
That's right. That's exactly right.
When Blake first tried to come back, and he was still suffering from the effects of the virus, the zoster virus that you mentioned, it had paralyzed half of his face, he was still in pain, and yet he won a match. How common among tennis players and pro athletes in general is the kind of determination he displayed?
It's difficult to say because most pro athletes are not put in the kind of position Blake was in. Certainly successful pro athletes don't reach the level that they've reached without being fierce, and fierce generally in their lives off the court as well as on the court. But to have battled back from as much adversity as Blake faced and to not take no for an answer from any doctor, really, and as I mentioned in the article, when he was in that hospital in Rome, the doctors wanted him to stay an extra couple of days, and he wouldn't stay. He said, I'm getting on a plane, I'm leaving now. Against doctor's orders.
This is when he had a broken neck.
With a broken neck, and with it not yet clear whether he had a broken back. And that's a long flight from Rome back to New York.
Well, and then a little later on, one of his doctors said as part of his rehab, he could walk briefly on a treadmill, and he started running, ran a couple of miles, and called the doctor and said, hey, this hurts my back a little bit.
That's exactly right.
The doctor said, you're not supposed to be running.
That's right. His work ethic is something tremendous, and at times it will get him into trouble a bit. But I think, in part, it comes from his father. He said that there was one time he played a match at Key Biscayne in tremendous heat, tremendous humidity. And afterwards, his father came up to him and said, good job, good match. So are you going to go for a run this afternoon?
People should understand, it occurs to me, this virus that we've talked about, zoster, people may not be familiar with it, but it paralyzed half of James Blake's face. And once he understood that that was a condition that remained for a while, his first response was, well, that's okay, I can still play tennis, I'll look a little funny, but I'll just wear a hat.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think there's something else that goes on with him is that on one level, he's just going to keep fighting. He's going to keep fighting until the end, no matter what's going on. I mean, that's part of why this story is so compelling, I think, is because it's not isolated incidents that happen to be consecutive. The incidents relate. I mean, it's odd that at the time when his father had stomach cancer and he was unable to visit his father, that one of the most poised, graceful athletes in the world happened to break his neck playing tennis.
Mm.
I mean, it's hard to draw a direct connection, but clearly there's something odd about that. So I think that's part of why this story is so intriguing, is that it's very much a story about a relationship between a father and a son, and not just a story about an athlete who's been injured, who then has to fight to come back.
The determination that you've talked about paid off at the Pilot Pen Tournament in New Haven, Connecticut last weekend. Blake won the tournament. Do you suppose that win was more satisfying than playing a very competitive match against Roger Federer earlier this season had been?
I think it was extremely satisfying for him to win it at New Haven. He was in front of his friends, in front of his mother. His girlfriend was there. That's always pleasant. And for it to happen in front of his hometown fans, for it to happen on the day that that article came out, which is odd, for it to happen just before the U.S. Open, which is the tournament that is the most important to him, I think had to be hugely satisfying for him.
Some of the players on the tour have said that James Blake has been more fun to be around since returning from his run of terrible misfortune. Did you ask him about a change in attitude?
I did ask him. He says that his attitude is not all that different. He says that he gets less angry after a loss, that he won't break rackets back in his hotel room as he used to. That said, I spent time with him after a loss or two, and he didn't seem all that chipper. So he does have his life as a tennis player and all that goes with that more in perspective. As for his being more fun to be around, I think he was probably always a fun guy to be around. He's quick, he's sarcastic, he loves to joke. Maybe he's a little less intense off the court than he used to be, but I'm not sure about that.
On Thursday, in the U.S. Open, the tournament that you have said is the one Blake himself considers most important, he enjoyed a resounding victory over Igor Andreyev, 6-2, 6-2, 6-4. He next plays against number 2 seed Rafael Nadal. John McEnroe, no less authority than John McEnroe, has said that Blake might have a chance to beat him. What do you think?
I think he does have a chance. Blake has tremendous speed, and his forehand is huge. And he's coming in with probably more confidence than he's ever had. He's also probably playing better than he's ever played. It's hard to say, but certainly it seems that the match is going to be competitive.
Howard Axelrod wrote the story on James Blake that ran in Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He joined me from Arizona. Howard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
It probably wouldn't surprise many auto racing fans to see God and NASCAR in co-promotion at a racetrack near Nashville, Tennessee, the shiny brass buckle of the Bible Belt. That recently happened, and it's not just a Southern phenomenon. Ministry organizations provide volunteer chaplain services to drivers, crews, and even fans at racetracks all over the country. This summer, Kim Green headed to a Busch Series race, and she has this report.
On a soggy June evening at Nashville Super Speedway's Busch Series Federated Auto Parts 300 race, a room full of drivers and pit crews bow their heads at the close of a driver's meeting.
So, Father, if you allow us to race tonight, we ask that we would race under your authority to reflect your glory. Amen.
Around 30 drivers and crews stay after the meeting to hear volunteer chaplain Kenny Crosswhite deliver a brief, informal sermon.
Life is bigger than that trophy, and you know it. What do you wake up every morning for? Guess I hope it's not just racing.
Motor Racing Outreach, or MRO, provides prayer and worship services to Christian racers, crews, and their families on the road when it's not usually possible for them to attend church. Chaplain Kenny Crosswhite says it all started about 15 years ago.
A man responded to several drivers' desire to have a spiritual element out here in racing. They started just meeting in motel rooms and meeting, but a lot of guys wanted to bring their families. They wanted someone there to care for them.
Bring homemade cookies.
Outside the track at Expo Row, where vendors huddle under tents against the drizzle, another organization called Raceway Ministries attends to fans' needs, both spiritual and otherwise. These volunteers are from Gladeville Baptist Church, a thriving congregation of around 1,000. They actually outnumber the population of tiny Gladeville, Tennessee, only 4 miles from the Super Speedway. A young volunteer named Christy says she works every race because it broadens her horizons.
It's an interesting experience to see all the people and how they react to just human kindness. Some people are indifferent and some people respond with kindness in turn.
Christy and other volunteers mainly just offer free popsicles and home-baked cookies to passers-by or help tourists out by giving directions to local hotels and restaurants. But sometimes people ask to pray together or exchange testimonies. Christy, who is hearing impaired, met a woman earlier this year who wanted to talk about her own hearing loss.
Because you never know when someone's going to benefit from your experience. It's a real blessing to me to be able to help people. And that's part of why I'm doing the racetrack ministry. Because you never know when somebody's going to come up for a free cookie and go away with a blessing.
The volunteers joke that nobody's asked for a prayer to stop the rain yet. But one middle-aged woman does drop a folded slip of paper into the prayer request box. Diana Sandrell, from Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, wants Raceway Ministries to pray for her son.
He doesn't believe there's a God. And I've prayed and prayed and prayed for him. And I haven't won him over yet. But Christ is working with him, so maybe I haven't gave up.
The Gladeville Volunteers are part of an association of small church groups around the country called the National Fellowship of Raceway Ministries. 50 tracks in 22 states participate, from Florida to New Hampshire to California, although Tennessee's in the lead with 9 Christian groups statewide. Each track has a ministry that sustains itself with donations from participating nearby churches. Raceway Ministries' loose affiliation with the drivers' group Motor Racing Outreach is more philosophical than financial. They share ideas mostly. And Raceway Ministries gives away special copies of a New Testament produced by MRO, complete with quotes from drivers about their faith. Gladeville pastor Phil Johnsey says they're not trying to proselytize.
So really what we try to do is be a shining light in a small mini city for 2 days that it's there, or 2.5 days. We're really not there trying to convert people as much as we're there just trying to serve, as Scripture says, give a cup of water in the name of the Lord. We're there to give away things, to assist people in whatever ways that they have. And we're not trying to hit people in the head with an 8-pound Bible and, you know, make them come down the aisle.
John Z admits that his work at the Raceway might not seem as vital as the church's mission trips to Kenya, India, or Honduras, where need is more desperate. But, he asks, why ignore your own backyard?
And I think God has always led us to that point of first do missions here, and that's where the racetrack has come in.
In the pits, it's nearly race time, and Pastor Kenny Crosswhite bobs from car to car, leaning in windows for a final whispered prayer with drivers who want one. But just as drivers rumble out onto the track for their warm-up laps, the drizzle ramps up to a steady patter, with no end in sight. Divine intervention seems unlikely, but for Crosswhite and the other Christian volunteers here today, that's not what prayer is about anyway. For Only a Game, I'm Kim Green in Nashville.
I was going pretty fast, I looked behind, and you caught my devil doing 99. I'm a little fire riding old man, I'm a little fire riding old man, I'm a little fire riding old man down the line. Come on, yeah. Well, I've led an evil life, I do say, but I'll have run the devil on judgment day. I'm a little fire riding old man, I'm a little fire riding old man, I'm a little fire riding old man down the line.
You're listening to Only a Game. Rick Ludwig, a Greenville, South Carolina listener who hears Only a Game on WEPR, wrote to take issue with something Dave Zirin said on last week's program. Mr. Zirin, the author of a new book entitled What's My Name, Fool? And subtitled Sports and Resistance in the United States, maintained that Washington Redskins owner George Preston Marshall named the team to appeal to Southern racists. Any credible journalist would have done serious research prior to making that false claim, Mr. Ludwig wrote. The Washington Redskins are the current incarnation of the Boston Redskins who were moved to Washington by Marshall in the 30s. I wonder how many Southern racists Marshall was attempting to market his team to in Boston. Mr. Ludwig has the chronology right. George Marshall's pro football team was originally known as the Braves, but Mr. Marshall changed the name to Redskins while the team was still in Boston and kept that name when they relocated to Washington. Rick Evans, who hears Only a Game on WBUR in Boston, took issue with David Zirin's contention that the owners of pro sports teams gouge fans. If you had to pay bottled water prices for tap water, that would be gouging, Mr. Evans wrote. High ticket prices is just evidence of sports fans with more money than brains. Court McMurray, who listens to Only a Game online, was especially provoked by Mr. Zirin's praise of Muhammad Ali and wrote, "Patriot or protester, Mr. Ali was always much more about self-promotion than fighting the good fight." An anonymous listener in Great Falls, Montana, was joined by Alan Friedman, who hears the program on WNJN in New Jersey, and by Stephen Russell, a WBUR listener, in complaining about an assertion last week by journalist and author David Walsh. During our conversation, Mr. Walsh maintained that Lance Armstrong's tests that proved positive for EPO coincided with his strongest days during the 1999 Tour de France. The listeners mentioned above pointed out that EPO does not provide a performance advantage until several days after it is administered, and that its full effect takes even longer to become manifest. When I spoke with him on Thursday, Dr. Charles Yasalis, the Pennsylvania State University professor who is an expert on performance-enhancing drugs, concurred with that assessment, although he does not regard it as evidence that Lance Armstrong didn't use EPO. You can send your comments via the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Our non-cyber address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Irish eyes smile on a stateside hurling match. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Up, Kerry! I'm sorry, go ahead. Got something visceral going.
Hurling in your blood there. The National Basketball League Players Association was the first such group to announce that it would assist in the relief effort following the destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina. Are you encouraged by the subsequent response by others in the sports community?
At this point, Bill, I'm encouraged by any leadership anywhere by people on a national basis, since we don't apparently have it where it's supposed to be. The enormous human tragedy of the hurricane is probably beyond description. But one thing that, at least in our little corner of the world, we have to remember is it affects an enormous number of people who play our games. This is a place where a lot of athletes come from, be it Brett Favre from coastal Mississippi or Steve McNair from central Mississippi or Chris Duhon from the Bulls from Slidell, Louisiana, a little town where I spent a lot of time that simply is not there anymore. So, yes, this is a very good thing going in a whole lot of different directions. I wish there was a little bit more direction from the people who get paid to provide direction and not provide bounce passes, but we'll take what we can get.
Well, as you mentioned, sports is a small matter compared to the suffering caused by the disaster, but the New Orleans Saints are without a home stadium for now. Earlier this week, they were confident, they said, that they would hold their home opener against the Giants on September 18th. Shouldn't the team worry and have been worrying about more immediate concerns?
Well, I think probably what that was a response to a question and an institution that was grateful to answer a sports question just for the purposes of not having to answer all the obvious miserable ones. I'm not exactly sure why they just don't move the team to San Antonio for a year. The Dome is there. It's not that far. It's a perfectly good place to live and work. Let us face absolute facts. It is unlikely the New Orleans Saints will be playing in New Orleans anytime for the next 3 or 4 years.
NFL owners have canceled a meeting scheduled for 10 days from now because the league and its players have not yet negotiated an extension to their collective bargaining agreement. Charlie, are those who are always ready for some football concerned?
Of course they are, because now the NFL owners are facing an actual horrors market. Because in 2007, if they don't extend the CBA, you'll have no salary cap in the NFL, and then the owners will actually have to bid for the disposable talent they ordinarily sign to contracts that aren't worth the paper they're printed on. And facing that horror, they're desperate to get something done.
I learned this week that USC quarterback Matt Leinart has a personal bodyguard, and 3-time Super Bowl champion Tom Brady of the New England Patriots has no such bodyguard. Draw me some conclusions, if you will.
I think it's probably the difference between Los Angeles and Foxborough. I don't have any real reason for that. I suppose it's because Brady probably doesn't want one.
University of Florida coach Urban Meyer has said that he won't return the large replica gator head that he removed from Ben Hill Griffin Stadium in April until his team earns it back. What prompted this draconian measure?
Authentic football coach foolishness is what prompted this. Coach Meyer is in his first year down there, so he's establishing his presence with authority, as Nuke Lush would say. The fiberglass gator head's probably in his office.
I think it's over his mantle.
I think it's probably in his office in a box, and they'll give it back to him after they beat whoever the first couple of sponge cakes on their schedule are.
In Major League Baseball news, Rafael Palmeiro has started wearing earplugs. No chance that will increase the ridicule he's already enduring, is there?
See, now, if I was really unkind, I'd ask you if he was taking the earplugs orally or intravenously, but I won't ask you that.
I'm glad.
He's 0-for-4 with 2 hits and 26 at-bats since the suspension. He's hitting .077. People are drawing obvious conclusions. People are screaming at him from the stands. as we've often say, sports are what the society has in place of a throne, and sports is what this society has in place of the stocks.
A contrite David Wells, what an odd juxtaposition of adjective and proper noun that seems, said this week that he was wrong to criticize Commissioner Budd's handling of the Palmeiro steroid affair. What do you suppose inspired Mr. Wells to see the light?
The Red Sox front office, who have no pitching and realize that David Wells is the ace of their staff and are trying to get him to shut up so he won't be suspended when they really need him.
Chicago White Sox ace pitcher Mark Burley this week accused the Texas Rangers of stealing the catcher's signs and conveying the information to Rangers hitters through, quote, a high-tech light system in center field. Wait a minute. Cheating in baseball?
Boo, 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 boo. No, this is great. I mean, it's proof positive that it doesn't matter how far the technology gets advanced. The goals are still the same. It used to be you stole signs because you had a drunken scout in center field with a pair of binoculars or some old lady in a tenement overlooking the right field fence, mm-hmm. you know, doing semaphore with, you know, the curtains to the dugout where Leo DeRocher would write everything down. Now we have high-tech electronics. It's fabulous.
The San Antonio Spurs will get former San Antonio Spur Michael Finley. He says he chose the better team over a more lucrative contract with the Miami Heat. Can you find fault with Finley's conclusion that he will have a better chance to win a championship with San Antonio?
Well, I think he'll have as good a chance to win in San Antonio. He played in Dallas. He's not moving that far. It's hard to argue against joining the Spurs at this point. You know, I'm sure playing with the Heat with Shaquille O'Neal and future president Dwayne Wade would have been a good time. But I think it's given the choice between where you want to play and Michael Finley being at the point in the career he is, it's really hard to argue with him going to San Antonio.
The Romanian Gymnastics Federation disbanded the team this week because two women on that team, including three-time Olympic gold medalist Catalina Ponor, had attended a birthday party. What do you suppose the Federation would have done if their athletes had been at a sleepover?
I mean, wasn't there a time in Romania where everybody in the government was basically drunk? This is, Ponor, who's 18, by the way, has told the Romanian television station that there were only athletes and she didn't drink alcohol and she was going to train hard for the World Championships in November in Australia, where I guarantee you, you and I may not understand this story, but the Australians really don't understand the story.
And finally, Charlie, streaking was a fad in the 70s. Could you have foreseen 3 decades ago that it would become a varsity sport someday?
Well, it's apparently people have been getting naked and running around Princeton for quite some time. It's campus tradition. But lo and behold, I discover from the New York Times that Hamilton College, alma mater of my oldest son, Abraham Doris Down, down there in Atlanta, also has a varsity streaking team. I'm sure glad he got out of there in time.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and, of course, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Naked hurling would be very dangerous.
He ain't blue. Boogity, boogity. He ain't blue. Boogity, boogity. He's just in the mood to run in the nude. Oh, yes, they call him the streak. Boogity, boogity. He likes to turn the other cheek. Boogity, boogity. He's always making the news. When just his tennis shoes. Guess you could call him you.
Sunday at the Irish Cultural Center in Canton, Massachusetts, was loud with bagpipes and bright with the colors of teams competing at soccer, Irish football, and hurling. The latter sport, which would have been much the most mysterious to anyone who wasn't Irish, had there been anyone who wasn't Irish in attendance that day, requires a bit of explanation. Eddie Carey, over this summer from Tipperary, has been playing the game since he was a lad.
You could describe it as close or similar to hockey, if you like.
Field hockey,
yeah. You're playing, we use sticks that are made from ash, from an ash tree. They're cut from the base of an ash tree where the root goes into the ground.
So it's got a kind of a ball shape or bulb shaped ending that you whack the ball with.
Exactly, yeah. The ball is called a schlitter, and that's the Irish word for the ball we use. And the stick we use is called a hurley.
Hurling is played on a field that looks like a soccer pitch, but it features goalposts similar to those on an American football field. The object of the game is to swing your hurley and bash the schlitter into the other team's net, scoring a goal, which is worth 3 points. You get 1 point if you can loft the ball between the goalposts that extend over the net. Points are fairly common and can be scored without warning, as some of the players can toss the ball in the air and hammer it through the posts from vast distances. Goals are rare, and of course the 13 players trying to move the ball toward the opposing goal by dribbling it on their hurleys or passing it on are continually harassed by the 13 players attempting to take it the other way. Rory O'Donnell, a reporter for the Irish Immigrant on hand Sunday, explained how defense works in hurling.
Well, what you can't do is you can't rugby tackle a guy. Like, you can't grab him around the waist and pull him down, or you can't push him or pull his jersey. If a player has the ball, what you can do is try and knock it off his stick with yours. Or what you can do is just try and shadow him until he has to strike the ball and try and block his shot.
The schlitter, which is about the size of a baseball, is pretty hard. The hurley is harder. Lots of the players wear no helmets, and serious damage would seem to be a predictable consequence in any hurling match. But everyone I talked with at Sunday's match assured me that bad injuries are rare, and Eddie Carey of Tipperary, sidelined with a bum knee, spoke of the game as it's played in Ireland in positively pastoral terms.
It's kind of a social outing, and everybody supports the local club. I'm from a little village called Mullinahone, and when we play a game every Sunday as well at home, and when we play, the village is deserted, everybody just goes to the match. So it is a big deal, and a lot of people, all week they're just going to be talking about the game, you know, so...
Is it strictly amateur, or is there
absolutely. And which is a good thing in one way, because it's our history and our heritage, and it always was that way. And I think a lot of people feel at home that if it became semi-pro or professional, that like it might ruin what the game is about.
The featured hurling match on Sunday in Canton was very much about Ireland, though the two clubs competing, Tipperary and Father Tom Burke's Hurling Club, are local. Each had imported half or more of its players from the land everybody on the premises called home, as indicated by the national anthem that came first as the players assembled at midfield.
Faithful sail, chanter our sins afaster.
The good warm fellowship disappeared a bit prior to the opening whistle, when referee Johnny MacDonald had to give two lads yellow cards for shoving and poking each other with their hurleys. Once the game began, Father Tom's took the offensive. The coach and trainer for Father Tom's, a fellow named Stanton, who was, like many of his players, a temporary import, could not be mollified by his team's hustle and early two-point lead. Neither could Matty Duggan, who founded Father Tom Burke's Hurling Club 50 years ago, after he'd moved to Boston from Galway, where there was a club of the same name. Duggan was too much the veteran player, manager, and observer to become excited at a slim lead, though he did acknowledge there on the sideline that it was better to be ahead than behind. By halftime, Father Tom's had extended the lead to 6 points, but Eileen Fox, serving her second year as chairperson of the club, was not able to relax.
Not today, not yet, but it's early stages. It's never over till the final whistle is blown here in hurling. Goes to down to the wire. As long as the goal comes the right time, that's all we want.
Perhaps the caution expressed by Matty Duggan and Eileen Fox was in part a function of the importance of the match. The tilt between Tipperary and Father Tom Burke's was, I was told, the equivalent of a county championship in Ireland. Beyond that, the winner would move on to the National Hurling Championships to be held September 4th in Philadelphia, and Tom's badly wanted the opportunity to defend the championship it had won the past two summers. Whatever the cause, the caution proved justified. In the second half, Tipperary came out a different team. They chiseled away at the lead until it stood at just 2 points again, and with 12 minutes left in the game, Alan Hogan netted the only goal of the day to put Tip, as the team is nicknamed, up by one. Tipperary fan Phil O'Neill explained that the momentum of a game could turn on a single goal.
It's a great morale boost because it is three scores, you know, so, I mean, three scores from play takes quite a bit of effort, so...
It sort of takes the wind out of the other side.
It takes the wind out of the other side, especially in a game like this where they've been leading since the start. A couple of points, you know, ahead all the time, then 6 or 7 points ahead, and to give up a goal, to go a point behind is a big blow, big blow. But I think what you see is Tipperary are stepping up a gear to the level they can play at.
The two teams traded points during the remaining minutes. Kieran Jordan, the goalkeeper for Tipperary, made two acrobatic stops to earn distinction as player of the match. And when the clock ran out, it was Tipperary on top by 3 points. As he came off the pitch, Alan Hoyle, winded as he was, tried to explain how the game had turned in his club's favor.
Hell.
Fouled out at half time, Nick. We weren't playing to our best. There was a bit of a breeze against us. And the humidity, we found it hard, but we got going the second half, and the halftime trick worked.
When I congratulated Hoyle on earning the trip to Philadelphia and a shot at the national championship, he put last Sunday's game in a perspective I'd not anticipated.
Yeah, and this year's new system, you know, we're straight into the final down there, so we only play on the Sunday. So, Philadelphia, we're not too pushed about it. This is the real team. Right. This is what we wanted.
In the ceremony following the game, before he would accept his medal for winning, Noel O'Grady of Tipperary reminded all assembled that the point of the day was camaraderie.
Big cheers for the Toms. Hip hip.
Hooray!
Hip hip.
Hooray!
Hip hip.
Hooray!
Still, winning is winning, and as the Tips posed for a post-match photo, they spontaneously broke into song. As the players, some of them still trying to catch their breath, shook each other's hands, Eddie Carey stood a bit apart from his victorious teammates. He'd come over from Ireland to play for the summer, then been injured in the season's first game and never taken the field again. But he'd stayed to support Tipperary, and he'd gained a quiet appreciation for the rewards of the effort, win or lose.
I suppose a lot of what the game is about out here is, like, you have home-based players here that are here long-term. They've been here maybe six, seven years or whatever, and then you get a few lads out from home that are just out for the summer to play. And the thing about it is, everyone gets together and it kind of creates a community here for the Irish, you know, so that's the big thing about it.
On Sunday, the time was short, even for such encouraging summary. The players had to leave the field so that another game could begin, Irish football this time. But tomorrow in Philadelphia, the Tips will be gathered again for hurling with a national championship on the line. And shortly thereafter, win or lose, it'll be time for Eddie Carey and his mates to return home.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary. To the sweetest girl I know.
Bless her.
Goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, Leicester Square.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Neil Fiedler. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to take a telephoto tour of the Tipperary Tough Guys, browse Only a Game show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Eileen Fox, chairperson of Father Tom Burke's Hurling Club of Boston, who offers to clear up my confusion over the words points and pints, both of which figure prominently in hurling.
A pint is black and white, a pint of Guinness, and a pint in the field is over between the two bars.
Well, I'm glad we got that straightened out, because you don't want to walk into a pub and order something and then get hit in the head with a stick. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.